and tell some truth about what the real story is and how we learn from that and move forward together. That includes something like appointing Deb Haaland to the Secretary of the Interior position, overseeing Native Affairs. Imagine having a Native person actually overseeing Native Affairs for the first time in U.S. history.
Sarah Housko, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Indigenous lawyer and activist, founder of the Ginu Collective. She is Ojibwe from the Kuchiching First Nation. And tune in tomorrow for our holiday special with Jody Archambault of Standing Rock, Ali Young in Arizona, Bree Newsom and Eddie Glaude, as well as Juan Gonzalez on Latino results from the election. And Friday, we re-air our documentary, 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Also, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM. And K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM. Next up, we have Wednesday Talk Radio.
My cue. Good morning, everybody. How are you all doing out there in Radio Land? I'm Paul Rowland, the regular weekly host of this program, Wednesday Talk Radio, here on KBOO. Got a really interesting show for the day before the Day of Mourning, otherwise known as Thanksgiving, for Native American Heritage Month, and the day before the celebration of the brutal English colonization of, quote, New England, also known as Thanksgiving. We take a deep dive into the historical underpinnings of and justifications for the expropriation of indigenous territories. In an article titled, Was the United States Founded as a Democracy? For his original Free Nations website, our guest Steve Newcomb writes, our nations and our peoples enjoyed a free and independent way of life before the invading Christian Europeans assumed a right of domination over our nations and our ancestors. This assumption of a right to domination came to be known as the Doctrine of Discovery, which we have discussed on this program before, and was based on a series of papal bulls issued in the 15th and 16th centuries. My guest, Steve Newcomb of Shawnee and Lenape Heritage, is the co-founder and co-director of the Indigenous Law Institute, along with Virgil Killstraight. He is author of Pagans in the Promised Land, Decoding the Doctrine of Christian Discovery, and co-producer of the documentary film, The Doctrine of Discovery, Unmasking the Domination Code, directed by Sheldon Wolfchild, a Dakota. Newcomb is one of the world's authorities on the Doctrine of Discovery. Based on the 40 years he has spent investigating and writing about these issues, he has been a tireless advocate for indigenous nations and peoples. And his work has helped the issue of repudiating the doctrine become a global movement. With that, I'll bring in my guest, Steve Newcomb. Good morning.
Morning, Paul.
How are you doing this morning?
Good. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. Well, to start with being Native American Heritage Month, perhaps you could start by talking a little bit about your own indigenous family heritage.
Well, let me back up for just a bit, because the bio you just read was it's a bit dated, and my friend and mentor Virgil Killstraight, with whom I founded the Indigenous Law Institute, he pass to the spirit world on February 10th of 2019. And so, you know, I have to modify that.
Sorry, I meant to check
that's
on
fine.
That.
But yeah, that's fine. No problem at all. And so, obviously, no longer co-director of the Indigenous Law Institute. But in any case, you know, I have to acknowledge Birchall as being the one who assisted me, took me under his wing, and supported this work. And I know without him and his mentorship and his teachings that I wouldn't be the person I am today, and also would not be doing the work that I'm doing today. So I just want to make that acknowledgement. With regard to our own family, you know, we're Shawnee and Lenape, originally from the eastern seaboard area in the Ohio Valley and those regions out there. And but our, you know, we were moved over many, many different removals. And eventually my grandparents, my native grandparents, on my mom's side of the family, ended up in Portland, Oregon, which is where I was born. And they went out to the Pacific Northwest during the Dust Bowl years. And my grandpa, who was a hunter and trapper and fisherman, he always wanted to see the Pacific Northwest. And so that's where they ended up. And so, you know, it's interesting to go all the way from the eastern seaboard to the western one. But so I have, you know, Portland is my hometown, so to speak, and
that's where we,
you know,
met.
Really, never. Yeah, exactly. Way back in the 90s, wasn't it?
Early 90s, yes.
Early 90s, very early. And but the you know, I had the good fortune of being influenced by medicine people and traditional elders from a quite young age. When our family, my immediate family, we lived in Los Angeles in the San Fernando Valley, and was able to had the good fortune of meeting traditional folks and being taught by elders and so forth. And that more or less started me on my journey. But family never really grew up with our traditions, our language, and so forth. My grandpa, Bushhead Spybuck Newcomb, he was ended up at Haskell Boarding School, and his dad, Solomon Newcomb, was there as well. And so, you know, the language of our people has been, oh God, I don't know how you say it, but in decline for a very, very long time. And now so far as I know, all of our elders that were born into the language as infants and raised in the language to adulthood are now all gone. So what do you do with your language at that point? But the thing is, with the boarding schools, because those were genocidal institutions designed to kill off our languages, cultures, and spiritual traditions, we now have the aftermath of that genocidal legacy on the part of the United States. And the way, you know, there are so many of our languages that are either, you might say, in intensive care or even in hospice because of that legacy and the effort on the part of the United States to destroy our ability to think differently, to have a different national identity from the United States in keeping with our original free and independent existence. So my early efforts to make sense of all this madness that I'm referring to, because I had always been a strong reader, I just decided to really dive deep. Well, I didn't even really make a decision. I just dove deep because of this yearning that I had to understand what in the heck had happened to our peoples and to our families specifically, but also to our all of our nations and peoples.
So
that's how
I
began
my
path.
Sorry. Well, just out of curiosity, you're talking about your family. Did anybody in your immediate or extended family, were they political in the sense that, you know, the Red Power movement, or not necessarily AIM, but was there that kind of consciousness around in your family?
No. No? Not at all. No. But, you know, fortunately, I mean, that was the right wounded era of Alcatraz, Wounded Knee, the quote-unquote Red Power movement, and so forth. So a lot of us of my generation, I'm 65 now, I was born in 1955, so a lot of us of my generation and earlier and were, you know, we grew up in that quote-unquote Red Power movement, the time of activism, and
so is that kind of what sparked you at the
Vietnam
time?
Oh yeah, mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Sure. Of course. How could it not? Right. So,
well,
yeah.
Well, I mean, some people definitely are ready for it, and some people aren't. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I think because of my effort to figure out what the hell had happened to our people, and I had a pretty formidable amount of anger about a lot of things, but about the fact that we didn't have our traditions and our language and so forth, and I hadn't been brought up with any knowledge or understanding of that, and I want to know why. And so I just wanted to figure it all out. So I read Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee when I was 16, and I think I was in 11th grade perhaps. I guess it was 11th grade. And then I went to history class, and I had been visiting with a lot of reservation Native people at that time, and getting a better sense of just tradition and generally and some of the history and so forth. So I remember holding my hand up in the history class because the history teacher was giving such a whitewashed version of history that was just it just made no sense to me, and I had just read that book, which has so many of the horrific instances of the true nature of the history and what went down, and he refused to call on me. So I just kept my arm up, and he still refused to call on me. And so finally, I started saying, "Why don't you tell him the way it really was?" And I said that a couple of times, and then he kicked me out of the class. And that was, you know, so I told him later, you know, he said, "You can't be doing that sort of thing." And I said, "Well, why don't you tell them the way it really was, that you were going to overrun this continent, that they were going to take over this continent, no matter who they had to overrun or who they had to kill in the process." And that's what I told him. And so that was when I was 16. So that gives you a sense of, you know, the kind of attitude I had at that time, and I've just carried that on ever since. You know.
Thank goodness for the rebels in whatever context, and for the rebellious spirit, especially if it doesn't get too suppressed and too whatever, that you find other less healthy outlets for it. But so I met you in the early 90s. So you mentioned Los Angeles and Portland. So at what point were you back in Oregon?
Well, I went to Oregon in 74, and I went to stay with my Native grandparents, my grandma Bessie and my grandpa Bush. And so I was staying there in Portland, and I was going to the Indian Center every week. And
The one up in Northwest Portland that got burned down?
I don't know if it got burned down, but at that time...
Well, that's what I heard. I mean, I never heard the full story of that anyway.
Ed Edmo and his wife Carol would go there. There were regulars there and a number of other people. And so, because I had quit high school and never really disclosed this before, but I had quit high school and no job prospects, and I was very frustrated. And at one of these sessions where they had, you know, beating and just getting together and socializing, I casually made the comment, just as an observation, that I, you know, since I couldn't find a job, it was an observation not a statement of what I was contemplating, but I said I can see how people might turn to a life of crime because they can't find a job, you know. And so they said, well, this guy's really far gone, you know. Anyway, so that was, I don't know, it was early in the week, and so I was able to, anyway, one thing led to another, and they assisted me to get into a high school equivalency program, and I guess I entered that program in February of 75, and then by April, I was enrolled at the University of Oregon. So that was pretty wonderful thing that they helped me with.
So cutting to the story that we're going to be talking about, so is it there that you got, you had mentioned in an earlier private conversation I had with you that you eventually started to read Vine Deloria, which is where you got
yeah.
this.
Well, I was already reading all kinds of stuff, and uh-huh. It was before I went to University of Oregon. I would just read everything I could get my hands on, and Vine's book God Is Red is one of the, had a big influence on me, and it was in that book that I read about the Vatican Papal Bull of May 4th, 1493. That's where I first came across mention of it. And then later, I had intended to go to law school and was going to prepare for that at U of O, and took a federal Indian law course from Charles Wilkinson. He was there at that time. And,
oh, yeah.
We were able
major
to get
figure.
Permission as undergraduates to go ahead and take that class if we were native. And so it was during that class and our assignment to read Johnson versus McIntosh. And while reading the Johnson versus McIntosh ruling and noticing that Chief Justice John Marshall had placed italics on the words Christian people and made a distinction between that and natives who were heathens, that's a direct quote. Well, in my mind, I immediately took that and associated that with the language from the Papal Bull, the Vatican document from 1493. And in my mind, I figured there had to be a direct connection between those two. But I had no real basis for that. It was just an intuition or maybe just putting two and two together, right? And because my mind tends to think in patterns, so to me, I thought there has to be a pattern there. But it makes
sense. Before you go on, I think it's crucial to actually explain. I think people can't hear enough about Johnson v. McIntosh because it was so foundational to the whole edifice, you know, of the sort of the mythic construction or justification for the sort of retroactive justification for the United States legal stand-in. Anyway, what was Johnson v. McIntosh?
Right. Johnson versus McIntosh is one of the most foundational property law cases in U.S. law, and it's also what it would be considered the starting point of not only the Marshall Trilogy, three different cases on Indian matters or issues written by Chief Justice John Marshall, but also the cornerstone of federal Indian law and policy, the starting point. And the case, without getting too much into it, had to do with these land speculation companies that entered into a pretend controversy with a guy named William McIntosh, pretending that their land areas were overlapping. And the question was whether the land speculation companies or William McIntosh had a superior title from the viewpoint of the courts of the United States. That's just the basic gist of the case itself. And that's a longer story about the whole collusion, if you want to call it that, the conspiracy or the plan, whatever the hell it was, that the land speculation folks and William McIntosh entered into by way of the attorneys. In fact, the attorneys for William McIntosh were on the payroll of the attorneys for the land speculation company interests. And so it's kind of bizarre. But in any case, yeah, Johnson versus McIntosh ended up deciding that Indian tribes, quote-unquote tribes, or that the Indians only had a right of occupancy or title of occupancy, whereas the colonizers, the first quote-unquote discoverers, had a title of ultimate dominion, direct quote their ultimate dominion. And so when you go into the word dominion, that's where you get into the domination language and the etymology of dominion, which goes to the root dominio in Latin, which is the verb for to dominate. And there's a very long explanation of all that. And then that ties into the domination language in the Vatican Papal Bulls, the Vatican documents. And so ultimately, it wasn't overnight. It took decades to figure out how to articulate and express these various ideas and not just reiterate or regurgitate what the colonizers have written, but to express it in our own words and from our own perspective, which I consider to be a perspective from the shore looking out at the colonizing ship sailing toward shore, whereas their perspective is on the ship sailing toward the shore. And so it's an entirely different perspective and therefore an entirely different explanation from our viewpoint and based on our understanding of how we want to express this language, this colonizer's language that we're using to communicate.
So let's bracket that and get back into the sort of the meat of the matter and how you sort of evolved your thinking and how you sort of applied that in working with different indigenous nations and all that, and your efforts to sort of quixotic, which hopefully ultimately won't be quixotic, attempts to actually get the Inter Soterra Bull revoked, which I say that not lightly, just that it is a long shot, I think you'll admit, but it has very, very real implications. But we'll talk about all that. I do want to say it's already 8:20, and my name's Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm talking with Steve Newcomb, and we're talking about the Christian roots of domination in the so-called New World as a Native American Heritage Month and day before the celebration of English colonization known as Thanksgiving. So I just want to get back to our own narrative. Let me just really quickly, because we met in the early 90s, just really quickly, because our trajectories met, which is that I moved to Portland, moved out to the West Coast, and then to Oregon in 1985, and fell in just sort of totally by chance with some pretty heavy duty Native American ceremonial practitioners and activists, including some AIM, American Indian Movement activists, and I came up to Portland for the trial of Dino and Gary Butler in the fall of 1985, who were like one of the last AIM trials, and met John Trudell and met a bunch of intense people and had all sorts of adventures anyway. And then I got involved in the whole fishing rights movement, which I kind of want to, I'm curious how you intersected with that, because you must have been around for some of that in the 80s. And anyway, so then I got involved in Earth First. I got involved in, as I said, the fishing rights movement by writing a lot of articles for the Portland Alliance and getting kind of close to the people in the Columbia River fishing community and some people from Yakima and Warm Springs. And it all kind of merged also in the Sacred Sites Protection Movement, et cetera, et cetera. And then, 1992 and the whole bringing up of the whole colonial legacy because of the 500th anniversary of Columbus. And so I'm not sure exactly at what point we intersected, but there was a lot going on, and I'm sure you were aware of a lot of that. What I remember specifically, and I think we had met before this, of the law conference, the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference in Eugene in 1993, which was Indigenous Roots, Indigenous Ties, or something like that. It was they delayed it a year. It was, I guess 1993 was the United Nations Indigenous Peoples Year, which they couldn't have had in 1992, I guess, for political reasons. But anyways, the theme was all indigenous issues, and a lot happened at that conference. But anyway, let me just, why don't you respond to what I was just saying?
I think that you and I met at a event up in at the base of Mount Hood, somewhere up there. It was I forget the name of the conference. I may be able to remember it.
Oh, the Sacred Earth Coalition Conference in Wemmy.
Yeah, I think it was. I think.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah. Where we had Jewel James and a whole bunch of really intense people. Yeah.
Right. So, but that was 92. But I believe it was 92. I don't know.
That makes sense.
I can't be right because I think it was 91 that you and I met, because in 92 it was February that Senator Inouye had the American Indian Religious Freedom Act hearings at Portland State University.
That's right, yeah.
And that's where I first had that insight about the idea of going to the Vatican and calling on them to revoke the Papal Bull of 1493. I walked out of the hearing, and I was rather frustrated that no one was bringing up Johnson versus McIntosh and the religious basis of that decision and its grounding in the Vatican Papal Bulls. And I saw my friend Mary Wood, who's a law professor at the University of Oregon. She was out in the hallway, and I expressed my frustration to her, and I said, you know, it just hit me at that moment. I said, you know, next year, in 1993, will be the 500th year since that document was issued. We should go to the Vatican and call upon Pope John Paul II to formally revoke that papal bull. And she said, that's a fabulous idea. And then I saw you not long after that and told you about that idea.
And then I had you on my radio show, which I had way back then.
Yeah. And then, but going back to that evening, this is what I thought was so funny. I went for a long walk in the dark out in the windy park there, and it was an amazing evening, and I had kind of this very, very powerful, palpable spiritual kind of experience, thinking about this idea of going to the Vatican and doing this work to call on the Pope to revoke the Papal Bull. And so when I was walking out in the park there, and it was so windy with those massive trees, and it was just electricity out there, you know, electric, and in terms of what kind of sensation I was having. And that was really interesting. And I went back to where they were having the powwow that evening, and I saw you. And you said, hey, Matthew Fox, who was a Catholic theologian, he's still alive. I think he's in the Bay Area. He just emailed me recently. But anyway, you said Matthew Fox is down the street speaking at, I think it was a Methodist church. We should go down there and talk to him about your idea of the Papal Bull. And so we went down there, as I recall, certainly I did, and when we walked in, it was just packed, absolutely packed. And he was just finishing up. He was in a Q&A, and then I thought, if I don't just get bold and ask my question, there's no way in the world he's just going to see my arm. And so at the moment, precise moment that he finished answering a particular question, I just stepped forward and called out his name and started to make a very, very concise statement about the history of the Papal Bull, Johnson v. McIntosh, the John Cabot Charter, and all these various things. And then I wrapped it all up by saying, and let me ask you, do you think that Pope John Paul II would formally revoke the Intercessio Papal Bull of May 4th, 1493? And I guess the way in which I asked the question and made sure it was super concise and so forth, it was very strange, and I thought it was interesting, because I think I had the energy to be that bull, to just step forward and do that because of the experience I had in the park walking out in the wind. And the whole church just erupted in applause at this question. And he said, I don't know if he would, but I certainly think he should. And furthermore, I think he should take all that gold out of St. Peter's Cathedral and give it back to the Indians they stole it from. And so I thought that was a pretty profound answer. But yeah, that was a really important moment. That was the very first time that I ever had that idea. And then it was shortly after that, in March, that I met my friend Virgil Kilstrate at the Peace and the Planet Symposium there in Eugene, Oregon, at the Valley River Center. And that was a whole amazing experience where I told him about the information, and he seemed very open-minded about it. And I told him, I'm going to be giving a keynote talk later this morning. Perhaps you can watch it. And then when I gave the keynote address and I got to the point of saying we should go to the Vatican and call upon the Pope to revoke the interest of chair paper, well, it was this kind of instantaneous standing ovation. It was weird. It was just this energy went through the whole audience. And so I think he saw that. And then so he said, you know, he wanted to arrange for me to go with him to Italy. And he and Jackie Bird go to Italy in the fall of 92 and go on a speaking tour. And so that's what ended up happening. There were so many things that happened that year in 92. I flew first before we went to Italy. I flew to Rapid City, met up with Virgil, and then we ended up going to Wounded Knee for a ceremony there and gave a couple talks. And the horseback riders came in from the four directions. It was just quite profound. And that was in preparation for going to the Vatican to go to the site of the Wounded Knee Massacre, where the 7th Cavalry had slaughtered the, so many of the Hunkpapa people and Chief Bigfoot and his people. And Virgil's grandpa was a survivor of Wounded Knee. So, anyway, yeah, there's just so much. And then by October of that year, maybe it was by November, I don't recall at the moment, but certainly in the fall, we ended up going on that speaking tour. We flew into Milan and went to quite a number of cities throughout northern Italy and all the way up to Trieste on the, what was at that point, the Yugoslav border. And so, yeah, it was just an amazing, amazing time.
Well, so we have a half an hour left. I do want to extend the invitation for people to call in and ask you questions. The number is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And because because there's so much, we're only at 1992. We've got 30 years?
Well, let me jump back in for just a second, because yeah. In 1992, you mentioned the Peace and the Plan. No, excuse me, the Land, Air, Water Law Conference at the University of Oregon Law School, and so one of the organizers had asked me if I wanted to give a talk, and that was in March, I believe. Yeah, March. So yeah. February was when I had this idea about the paper balls. March, early March, was when the conference was going to happen. And I said, yeah. And so he said, well, what title do you want? And I said, in any case, I chose the title, American Indians as Infidels in U.S. Law. And then, I had totally forgotten about this. And suddenly the day arrived, and I thought, oh my gosh, I totally forgot about this talk. And it was a noontime talk, so I ran over to the law school, and I looked around a bit, and I thought, well, maybe it's not happening. So I started to, I started walking down this one hallway, and here was this huge, huge sheet of paper, butcher paper, on the wall that said, 12 o'clock talk, Steve Newcomb, Native Americans as Infidels in U.S. Law, and it gave the room number. So I went over there, and it was just in the nick of time, and I thought, well, maybe there's only a couple people, so it'll be all right. And so I threw open the door, and it was packed. The room was absolutely packed, standing room only. And I think I gave one of the best talks I've ever given, you know, in my life. I think it was, I was just inspired, and it was, and I just.
Well, sometimes you can overthink it and overprepare it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, but that was a fun, I would just want to relate that story.
Yeah, yeah, and then we'll talk about the next year, which was a huge big deal for all of us, but also in the middle of just so much that was happening in the Northwest and elsewhere. But I just wanted to just to make sure we get this, and this might end up being a long excursus. And I do want to encourage people to call in 503-231-8187 to talk with my guest Steve Newcomb. Okay, so this project, explain. I think it's already sort of implicit if people all got what you were talking about with Johnson v. McIntosh. What is the purpose of revoking the Inter-Cetera Bowl first? And second part is, just give a brief encapsulation of maybe your efforts, successes, failures, and where you think it might be going. But what's the purpose of doing that?
Well, as I had, it was simply a notion that I had. It would be an interesting thing to do, to call on the Pope to revoke that papal bull. And I didn't really think it through. It just was kind of a inspired moment that, hey, this is a cool idea, and concurred with by Mary Wood, Professor Mary Wood. But as I look back on it now, and as I've understood for quite a long time, a lot of it has to do with putting a very high bar to the Vatican. In other words, setting a very high bar for them. They're unlikely to revoke something that the Pope has issued. And then it turns out it's not just one, it's many, many different Vatican papal bulls that have a similar spirit of domination in them. And so that's one part of it. The other part of it is, when I was at the Vatican in the year 2000, the head of the Jesuit order asked me if I thought the Pope would actually revoke the papal bull. And I said, well, perhaps he will or perhaps he won't. But as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't make that much difference because in the long run, it's the journey itself that's, you know, where the importance lies. And what I mean by that is being able to educate people about the real true nature of the system. You have to have a platform for that. And so calling on the Vatican to formally revoke those documents provides an opportunity to educate people as to what is in those documents. And the language from 1452 in the Papal Bull Dum Diversus, which says invade, capture, vanquish, and subdue all Saracens, pagans, and other enemies of Christ, reduce their persons to perpetual slavery, and take away all their possessions and property. That is absolutely horrific language. Horrific language, by the way, that the Vatican has never publicly acknowledged that it ever issued. And it issued that not just in 1452, but similar language in 1436 with regard to the Canary Islands, but also in 1454, 1455, 1456, 1481, 1493, four in that year, 1506 and 1514. And so this pattern of calling for the establishment of a system of domination over all non-Christian lands and using that against all non-Christian nations and peoples throughout the planet has been something that people have not understood because it's been cloaked in the guise of evangelism and bringing the gospel to the unwashed heathen and all this nonsensical language in the context of the domination code and the domination system. So it provides us with the opportunity to have conversations like this to bring that out into the open. That's where
But surely you must at some point have seen it as having strategic political possibilities. I mean, what might be the real world implications of such a revocation?
Well, the if you undermine the idea that original nations have only a non-property right of occupancy and are therefore completely vulnerable to those who have the ability to claim a right of domination and exercise a right of domination against them, then you've done something very political. in the sense of the whole nature of the global system of domination, the world order of domination, is then being reconfigured in some manner. And see, the problem is that, I'll give you a real quick example. A lot of people use the phrase "the system." Hear it all the time. Well, you know, the system. That phrase, the system, is part of a much larger thought and comprehensive thought, which is the system of domination. If you heard people say all the time, as many times as they say the system, if you heard them instead say the system of domination, well, you know, the system of domination, that's just the way it works in the system of domination. Suddenly, what is in the background is the operating system is then in the foreground. And then so much of what we see in the world as consequences of a system of domination and dehumanization becomes understandable. Because then you can create a category, examples of the domination system, and then you put under that all of the ways in which the domination system manifests a horrific experience of life on planet Earth. It's driven by the people that know how to operate that system of domination and that derive their economic benefit and their billions and billions and billions and trillions of dollars on the basis of that system of domination. So the revocation is really talking about, I didn't understand this initially, but it's really talking about calling into question the idea that there is such a thing as a valid claim of a right of domination against other nations and peoples, against other human beings. And so that, to me, that's a very tall order, very profound, but it's tremendously significant.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we're not having any callers, let's just continue with this fascinating conversation. Again, I'm speaking with Steve Newcomb. We have exactly 20 minutes left in the program. So if you do want to get in a call, don't wait another 10, 15 minutes, but try to get it in soon so you can do that. I just want to, you know, you mentioned Vine Deloria. You can't repeat his name enough. He was so foundational and formative to generations of both indigenous and non-indigenous students and thinkers on all these issues, including myself. I've got a bunch of his books, so people would always do well to read Vine Deloria. Of course, there's been others who've mined this. I thought I had your book of Pagans in the Promised Land. I couldn't locate it, but I do have the book by Robert Miller, who is another one who's been thinking and writing a lot about this. His book, Native America, Discovered and Conquered, Thomas Jefferson, Lewis and Clark, and Manifest Destiny, which I'd really recommend for people, particularly in the Northwest, to understand all this. I just want to read something real quick, which I could probably find in your writing, something very similar, but then have you respond to it, because it gives you really specifics for what you're saying. The doctrine has been traced as far back as medieval times in the Crusades to recover the Holy Lands in 1096 to 1271. Even before that time, the Roman Catholic Church and various popes had established the idea of a worldwide papal jurisdiction, which created a legal responsibility for the church to work for a universal Christian commonwealth. This papal responsibility, and especially the Crusades, led to the idea of a holy war by Christians against infidels. It's going to be a little long, but just bear with me. I think it's worth it. In particular, Pope Innocent IV's writings in 1240 influenced the famous 16th and 17th century legal writers Franciscus de Victoria and Hugo Grotius when they began writing about the discovery doctrine. Pope Innocent considered whether it was legitimate for Christians to invade infidel lands. He answered yes, because the Crusades were, quote, just wars, and that whole just war thing goes back to all that, fought for the, quote, defense of Christians. Pope Innocent focused on the legal question of the authority of Christians dispossess infidels of their dominium, their governmental sovereignty, and their property. The Pope's answer was that the non-Christians' natural law rights to elect their own leaders and to own property was qualified by the papacy's divine mandate to care for the entire world. Because the Pope was entrusted with the task of the spiritual health of all humans, and this resonates so much with a lot of the Christian right stuff that's going on, but that necessarily meant the Pope had a voice in all the affairs of all humans. It was the duty of the Pope to intervene even in the secular affairs of infidels when they violated natural law, as that natural law was defined by the Europeans and the Church. And of course, it goes on and on. It's important to get all that. But let me just get your response to that, and then we do have a caller after you say your piece.
Well, my goodness, there are so many things that can be said about that particular passage. Going back to the title of Robert Miller's book, I always wondered why he decided to refer to Native nations as conquered. And so I have a real problem with that. And that word conquered is a synonym for the word dominated. And acknowledging the system of domination, which is what you're seeing in that passage that you are hearing, whatever, when you're reading it, you're seeing it. But when we're hearing your words there, when you read that passage, we're hearing a description of their domination system. And so my quick response to that is all of our nations are original nations, meaning original to this continent, to this hemisphere. All of the nations from Europe, or the peoples from Europe, or Christendom, or Christian Europe, whatever you want to call it, are second in time, second in right. They're latecomers to the continent. Our ancestors and our nations had an original free and independent existence to point back to when the colonizers showed up. And we were completely free and independent of their ideas and their arguments in terms of being first in time, first in right, and not being subject to their jurisdiction, meaning them, they're the people across the ocean, subject to their jurisdiction or their claim of a right of domination. So then the question becomes, how does the assumption arise that as soon as those people show up by ship and walk ashore, that suddenly the people here, existing free and independent, are suddenly subject to the thoughts, ideas, and arguments of the colonizers? The way it arises is because that is the form of storytelling that they engage in, and then we end up conditioned to that form of consciousness or that kind of mentality from a very young age through the quote-unquote educational process, the mind control process of the dominating system. And it's only by a miracle, I think, that you can, or some really good upbringing traditionally, that you can free your mind of that assumption that suddenly our nations and peoples are subject to their thoughts and ideas. If Chief Justice John Marshall and the Supreme Court issue a decision that suddenly all of our nations or peoples are subject to that decision, based on what? Based upon a claim of a right of domination that they can come to a faraway land across the ocean and claim possession of that through a ritual, metaphorical, symbolic ceremony, and simply say, okay, voila, as if by magic, this is now ours. We claim a right of property, meaning a right of domination in relation to this place, and therefore anything that we say, anything that we write on paper, they're subject to, because we're brought here, we're sent here by God, by our God. So, I mean, that in a nutshell kind of sums up the way in which I think about these things, but we could go into a much longer and deeper conversation about it. But
which we can't do right now because we only have 10 minutes left, and we do have phone caller. So let's get to Donga. Go ahead. You are on the air.
Yes. I just wanted to know what was revoked, or what was the title of the papal bull that is under discussion?
Well, there are a whole bunch of them. There's the Dum Diversus, the Romanus Pontifex.
Wait a second.
The one in 14. Go ahead.
Just give me the main one that I can research on.
Well, if you want to, there are a couple of sources you could go to. You could go to a book by...
I just want the name of the bull.
The Inter Cetera, May 4th, 1493, okay. Papal Bull. Or the inter, okay. And that's spelled I-N-T-E-R, I-N-T-E-R, inter.
I-N-T-E-R.
T-E-R. And then the second word is C-E-T-E-R-A. C-E-T-E-R-A.
R-A. Enterera.
Intercetera. Like et cetera.
Intercetera.
Okay. Intercetera. Mm-hmm.
Interceptor. Okay, there you go.
Interceptor.
That's
yeah,
right.
That's just one of them.
Okay, that's a good start. And what year was that?
1493, May 4th. There's one from May 3rd as well. May 3rd and May 4th, 1493, same title.
Okay, I appreciate it. What's your name again?
Steve Newcomb. Stephen Newcomb.
Okay, Steve. Is there any other stuff I can read by you?
Well, you can go to our website, kboo.fm, and look up Wednesday Talk Radio, and you can get access to his websites and all that.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thanks. Good work.
Thank you for calling.
We might be able to get one, maybe two more callers in, 503-231-8187. Usually get a lot more. I think people are really, really into what they're hearing. But another thing I just want to, I know there's that 30 years of history since 1993 that we could get to, but before we get a little more into the history, you know, Amy Coney Barrett, it's so eerie that she's now a Supreme Court judge, and she seems, you know, that, you know, all the others would probably want to, you know, hem and haw about all the stuff you're talking about. But it's almost like she would claim it lock, stock, and barrel.
Well, it depends on how it was being framed. It's hard to know. I had a conversation personally with Justice Antonin Scalia back in, I think it was 2006. Yeah, it was. It was August of 2006. And when I asked him about the papal bulls and about the doctrine of discovery and about Johnson versus McIntosh, he claimed to not know anything about the doctrine of discovery or Johnson v. McIntosh.
That's scandalous.
So I was dumbfounded by that. But anyway, I wrote him a one-page thank you letter, and I put into the thank you letter sources with page numbers so that he could go, or an industrious clerk could go and get these sources for him. And I think, so that was August. By November, the Supreme Court had invited Lindsay Robertson, who wrote the book Conquest by Law, to go to the Supreme Court and give them a briefing on the Johnson versus McIntosh ruling. Now you have the Yakima Nation delivering its amicus brief, friend of the court brief to the Supreme Court during the Cougar Den case, and that has been read by, I don't know, all the justices, but the majority decision that was favorable to Yakima Nation in 2019, I think it was. So September 8, 2018, they submitted that brief to the Supreme Court, and by the spring of 2019, the court ruled in favor of the Yakima Nation. And the amicus brief of the Yakima Nation is actually referenced, so we know they read it, and is referenced in the majority ruling. So the thing is that the in the Yakima Nation legal brief, it references the doctrine of domination, Christian domination, dehumanization, genocide, all these things, the papal bulls, the Johnson v. McIntosh ruling, all of these various aspects of the system has been referenced in that legal brief. It's the first time in history that a Native nation has managed to be able to deliver something like that to the Supreme Court. And my question would be, what took so long? But that's because of the leadership of Chairman Joe Day Gowdy at that time. He's no longer in that role, but, and also the Yakima Nation as a whole and its council, being willing to take on this very, very important matter and express that kind of information to the Supreme Court. So they're aware of it. And whether Amy Barrett would acknowledge it, or in what manner or whatever she might acknowledge it, I have no idea. But that's the kind of conversation that should be happening. Why is it that the federal Indian law system is premised on the Bible and Christianity and Vatican papal bulls from the 15th century that are directly tied into the Johnson versus McIntosh ruling? And we have tons of documentation to substantiate that statement on my part.
Well, let me go to our last caller, second and last caller, because we're running out of time. Go ahead, Thomas. What's your question?
Well, I don't really have a question. I just have an observation. You know, a lot of this stuff, a lot of these documents and things sounds like ancient history, and I understand that the indigenous peoples are, you know, they're fighting with this stuff every day, but you hardly ever hear anything about it. But then I thought, wait a minute, is that really true? You know, and every time I turn around on the news or something like this, they're always invoking God, telling people to pray, the soldiers are going to war, praying to kill people, and all of this kind of a thing. And I mean, to me, and listening to this discussion this morning, which I think is just fantastic, they're still doing it. They don't refer to the papal bull, but that the God thing is still there. And I mean, that's just how they came across to this continent with God and their cross, and they're still doing it. And you know, it really disturbs me that I have to hear that all the time, you know. And, boy, they don't want to back down from that, you know. And so, anyway, it's just an observation.
Okay, let's let Steve respond, and then we got to wrap up. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, okay, so, by the way, I want to mention my daughter, Shauna Blue Star Newcomb, with whom I'm now working. She lives in Eugene, and so that's terrific, because she grew up with this her whole life. And then also redthought.org, that's Joe De Gaudi's website platform. But to wrap up on that note, this gentleman has mentioned the idea of God. Well, in the papal bull of May 4th, 1493, you have the statement in there, we trust or have confidence in him, capital H on him, which is referring to their deity, from whom empires and dominations and all good things proceed. So most people don't realize that it's a god of domination that's invoked in the Vatican papal bulls, that empires and dominations are coming out of that. And so they don't have to invoke or refer to papal bulls explicitly. It's the overall system of domination premised on a rationalization that they have an authorization from God to proceed and continue on in the same destructive manner that they have been. So
and where else do we find that phrase, in God we trust?
Well, there you go, on the filthy lucre. In any case, I really appreciate you having me on the air. Maybe we can do this again. There's so much more to cover, but, you know, we've done a pretty good job this morning, and I really value our friendship, and I thank you. And it's fun to think back on all those years ago when we were, when we were friends back then. So it's pretty
neat. We still got a couple minutes. So just to sort of maybe leading into the future, or just talk about, you know, have you had positive responses? You mentioned Scalia, but, you know, from within the domination system, have there been any cracks or openings that you're pursuing, perhaps?
Well, I don't know that I would frame it that way. I think anytime you're helping people to become aware of things that they're unaware of, that are right there in the open, but people are not aware of framing them in that way, that's a positive thing. Because we're all in this together. Those of us that are subjected to the domination system all throughout the planet, we have that in common. And we can collectively say no. We can collectively say no. We're not going to allow life to be organized on this planet around the theme and behavior and thinking of domination. We're going to organize on a different basis. I do want to say that our movie, The Doctrine of Discovery, Unmasking the Domination Code, will be up online through our original Free Nations website here probably by the end of the week, for sure. And so people will be able to go there and rent or purchase the movie. That's a major breakthrough in our work. because we've been able to concisely put in an hour and 1 minute the explanation of how this all came together and how it continues to be used against our nations and peoples and against the whole planet. So I think that's more and more people are waking up to what we're saying, and we've got a long ways to go, though. So, yeah.
And the person that you're going to hear going out, Buffy St. Marie, is in the movie, I understand.
She is, and my gratitude to Sheldon Wolfchild from the Dakota Nation, who directed the movie, and without him, there wouldn't be a movie. So it was a collaborative effort and took a long time to figure out how to tell the story. I think we've been pretty successful with that, and you know, we just have so much work to do to figure out how to begin to create the positive alternatives to the domination system based upon the seven laws of the Oglala Lakota Nation, as an example, or the Ocheche Chicoan Nation. And many, many different original nations have those types of positive laws and principles that are based upon a respect for all forms of life. And when we wrote our letter to the Pope back in 1993, we said, we invite you to walk with us on the sacred path in honor of the first original or the first indigenous principle, respect the earth as our mother and have a sacred regard for all living things.
Well, and speaking of that, it sounds like we're out of time. I thank you and invite people to go to our website at Wednesday Talk Radio at KBO.FM. Thank you so much, Steve. It's been really nice hanging out with you on the phone.
Thank you, Paul. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m. Sponsor of the Salem.